Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to the music of Frederick Delius. Delius was an English composer who was born in 1862 and died in 1934. And I'm entitling this show, My Lifelong Love for a Pagan Composer, that is, Frederick Delius. And why I'm calling it that, I'll tell you in just a moment. First, I want to say that I met Delius's music purely by chance, by accident. In 1971, I was watching television. I was a graduate student at Princeton University in theology. And I was watching BBC and came across a film entitled Song of Summer, which was made by Ken Russell, who's well known for a number of other films. But this particular film was just a one-hour look at the last year or two in the life of Delius. He by then was blind and paralyzed, but a young man had come, a young Catholic man named Eric Finby, had come from England to help him finish several compositions which lay unfinished on his desk. And the music that played during this film just so overwhelmed me that I immediately went out and found every Delius recording I could. And, of course, in those days, they were all on vinyl. And ever since then, ever since the age of 22, I'm now 66, I've absolutely loved this man's music. Now, let me tell you about Delius, and let me tell you why I'm calling him a pagan composer. Delius himself was a very outspoken atheist, an admirer of Friedrich Nietzsche, particularly his book Thus Spake Zarathustra, which he set to music in a piece called Mass of Life. As a young man, he refused to work in the father's wool business and went off to America and then Leipzig and then Paris and lived as a bon vivant, wine, women, and song. He caught syphilis. He would eventually suffer paralysis, then blindness, and he would die from it in 1935. But the greatest champion of his music was the English conductor Sir Thomas Beecham, who said of Delius that he was the last great apostle of romantic beauty in music. Now, I'll have to tell you that in 1971, when I became a Delius fan, it was a time of crazy modernism in music, and anyone who touted a romantic composer, especially one not very well known, was considered more or less completely out of his mind. You know, as one music critic called it, you might as well have accused yourself of being a heroin addict as to have been a fan of Friedrich Delius. But I want to explain why I think someone like myself, or maybe even you as a listener, as a Catholic, as a Christian, as a believer, can in fact love the beauty made by artists like Delius, atheist though he was. I'm not going to invoke the old adage, art for art's sake, because it's really not about that. It's about the nature of beauty, the way artists make beauty through art, and how we relate to that. The beauty in art attracts our human desire for happiness, total happiness, that is, which can only be found in God. In this world, we find limited or imperfect happiness, and part of that is in the beauty that we meet in nature, in other people, but especially in great art. And the artist who creates this beauty is expressing his or her desire, that longing that arises from this desire for happiness, which is innate, it's created in us. And even an artist who does not believe, who may even reject the idea that his desire to create comes from a desire for God, for eternal happiness, he is expressing that desire in his art, in the beauty that he creates. As I once described in an essay on the aesthetics of Jacques Maritain, the experience of beauty can be described as when the ecstasy of the artist meets the ecstasy of the audience, or in this case, the listener. In other words, the artist goes out through his work to create beauty for someone else to enjoy or to encounter, and that person, the audience, is caught up and wrapped into the beauty created by the artist, and they meet there somewhere in the air where that beauty lies. So Delius's music for me, in spite of his unbelief, perhaps even in part because of it, depicts the rawness of that aspiration, that spiritual aspiration. Depicts its heights of ecstasy, its rushes of joy, its moment of vision, its moment of revelation, and then also depicts, perhaps even more often in Delius, frustration, loss, disappointment, and death. You will hear, as I tell this story, more about the other Christian admirer of Delius, the other Catholic admirer of Delius, Eric Finby, who in his last years went to help him. And I was privileged to meet Eric Finby some years later, and we shared some good laughs about the fact here we were both serious Christians both Catholic, and having gone some distance to meet one another to talk about this atheist composer. Now, one reason I have even brought this up at all is because of the fact that in recent years, there's been a notable effort by Christians who want to enter the cultural marketplace. They want to come in with artworks that bear a very bright and unmistakable Christian logo. In other words, this work of art is Christian for Christians or to convert people to Christianity. I believe that it's very often the case that those works of art fail. They fail both artistically and fail evangelically precisely because they have failed artistically. Because after all, it's the beauty that attracts us to the artwork rather than the intent of the artist to convert, the intent of Christian producers and Christian artists. Their intent is not what's going to drive the success of the artwork. Rather, the success of the artwork is going to determine the success of its power to attract and to convert. So I prefer that we talk about artistic spirituality. We talk about the way in which an artist, he or she, responds to this innate and inescapable hunger for happiness, which ultimately is found only in God. It's called spirituality precisely because it expresses the artist's effort to capture, to touch, to evoke what we might call the absolute, or Delius might have wanted to call nature with a capital N. Before we move to the next piece of music I want to play, which he wrote at the age of, some ridiculous age of 23 or 4, with very little music behind him. As I said, Fritz Delius, as he was called then, that was the name given to him by his German-Dutch parents, both immigrants from Germany in 1850. Delius himself had 3 brothers and 10 sisters. He didn't want to go into the family wool business, so his father, in desperation, sent him at age 22 to Florida to manage an orange grove just south of Jacksonville, Florida, on the St. John's River, a place called Solano Grove. Now, there, he started hearing the music of African Americans. Waiters in Jacksonville hotels would sing spirituals to the people in the hotel in the dining room. And as Delia sat on his veranda in his little house there next to the St. John River, he would hear African Americans working in the fields and in the groves singing these spirituals and also seeing them on steamships as they came down the St. John River. He could never get that music out of his head, and it was the most important part of his musical inspiration that led him on until his death in 1935. He would leave for Europe, return, I should say, in 1886 at age of 24. He got his father to pay for his tuition at Leipzig Conservatory, where he ended up meeting the very famous composer, Edvard Grieg. And Grieg was very much taken by an early piece that Delius had actually started composing before he left the United States, called the Florida Suite, based upon his year there on the St. John's River. And having heard it played for him by one of Delius's teachers at Leipzig, he convinced the father to continue funding his son Fritz's musical career. So let's listen to one movement from this piece of music that won over both Edvard Grieg and eventually led to further support from Delius's father. This is the second movement, entitled By the River, from the Florida Suite, played by Vernon Handley and the Ulster Orchestra. Thank you. the second movement of Frederick Delius's Florida Suite called By the River. If you had heard it without any introduction, I bet you would not have guessed it was written by a Brit born of two German immigrant parents to the UK. This young man had obviously absorbed not only the music of African Americans around him, but of the sense of the South and of America. And it's a very popular piece. It's played quite a bit. It's just a delight all the way through. It doesn't have what many people would call a great deal of depth or substance, but it's certainly tuneful, and it's very engaging. Another piece that he would write on the basis of his time in America is an opera called Coanga, which turned out to be the first African-American opera ever written. That is, every character in that opera, Coanga, is African-American. And this was begun in 1895. It wasn't finished until 1904, but it actually predated Gershwin's famous Porgy and Bess by 30 years. We move into a period in Delius's life when he left Leipzig and went to live in Paris for 8 years. He lived there with his uncle, well-to-do uncle, Theodore Delius. And while in Paris, became great friends with very noted figures such as Paul Gauguin, probably his best friend, the Norwegian painter Edvard Munch, famous for The Scream, and the Danish dramatist August Strindberg, very famous for a number of his plays. He was a very tall, handsome man, very well dressed, very much pursued by the ladies and pursuing of the ladies. And it's probably during these years in Paris, in the 1890s, that he contracted syphilis, which would destroy his life later on. But it was also during this time that he met his wife-to-be, Jelka Rosen, who was a very close friend of the sculptor Rodin, and also a follower of the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. So after Jelka, who had a little money, bought a house in a village 40 miles outside of Paris, Gray-sur-Lyon, they eventually married and went to live there. And it was during this period, after 1888, when they moved to the village, that Delius really matured as a composer. And I've got a long list of pieces here that he became famous for: Brig's Fair, In a Summer Garden, Arabesque, an opera, Fenimore and Goethe, A Song of the High Hill, Summer Night on the River. But the piece we're going to listen to is an example of Delius, perhaps at his best known and his best. It's a short, we call it a tone poem. It's entitled On Hearing the First Cuckoo in Spring. Delius, he and Jelka had a beautiful garden in their backyard. It was on a small stream, and evidently there was a cuckoo out there who sounded just like a clarinet. And so this is what Delius wrote and published in 1912, On Hearing the First Cuckoo in Spring, performed by Sir Mark Elder and the Halle Orchestra. This is one of the best-known compositions of Frederick Delius. On hearing the first Cuckoo in Spring from 1912, lush, sonorous, you can hear, you can envision what's contained in the title, the sound of a cuckoo on the clarinet in spring. Now I want to turn to another very recognizable piece by Delius entitled Walk to Paradise Garden. This was actually added to an opera that Delius finished in 1906 called A Village Romeo and Juliet, not based on Shakespeare, but based upon a novella by the German writer Gottfried Keller. And in this Walk to Paradise Garden, this purely orchestral part of the opera, the two lovers, Sally and Vreeli, they experience their moment of pure happiness, of pure unadulterated joy in each other. We're going to listen to this, and then we're going to listen to what happens to Sally and Vreeli in a little while. But for now, enjoy the fact that these two lovers are very, very happy being together. Walk to Paradise Garden, played by Sir John Barbaroli and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. This is Walk to Paradise Garden by Frederick Delius from his opera, A Village Romeo and Juliet. We'll be listening to more Delius after this short break.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the question of the role and place of women in the Eastern churches can be found, as always, in the liturgical life of the church, especially today, the Sunday of ointment-bearing women.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. When Jesus rose from the dead, an angel descended from heaven, rolled the stone away, and sat on it. This was not so that Jesus could get out, but so that his followers could see that the tomb was empty. The angel's actions also mean that we will walk out of our graves. The stone sealed human beings in the grave, but after rolling it away, the angel sat on the stone, symbolizing that death is conquered and cannot any longer hold humanity captive to the grave. Our destiny is now the heights of heaven. That's what God thinks of human life, and that's why we work to end abortion, euthanasia, and every other form of violence. Ultimately, abortion is a denial of Christ's resurrection, but our Easter faith impels us to extend the victory of life. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Stand up and defend life while celebrating over 30 years of saving moms and babies from abortion. Mother and Unborn Baby Care is having their annual spring dinner at the San Marino Club in Troy, Thursday, April 21st. The keynote speaker is international recording artist Donna Scallon. Call for tickets at 248-202-4903. That's 248-202-4903. Join us because life is worth celebrating.
At the end of the last half hour, we listened to an orchestral moment from the 1906 opera by Frederick Delius, A Village Romeo and Juliet, where the two lovers, Sally and Raleigh, experienced the pure joy of their love. Well, it is called Romeo and Juliet, and therefore not all is going to go well. And in this scene, we find that they have gotten in a hay barge, and they're down the river floating, presumably to their death. Here we hear Robert Teer and Elizabeth Harwood playing the lovers, conducted by Meredith Davies. Isn't that just magical when Fraley's voice, sung by Elizabeth Harwood, comes in and sings, "This is the garden." And the other voices are the voices of boatmen who are watching them float by. We're going to come back to our lovers, Fraley and Sally, in the very last musical example in this program. But now we're going to turn to what is my most favorite piece of Delia's, my favorite composition. If I was to take one to a desert island, it would be this. It's called Sea Drift. It was completed in 1904. It's based upon the poetry of Walt Whitman as found in Leaves of Grass. And this particular episode in Leaves of Grass, a young man looks at a pair of mockingbirds nesting. And then one day he sees the she-bird fly away and never returned. And he, reflecting on the loneliness of the male bird, who continues to stay in the nest, waiting for the she-bird to return. We're going to listen to the section called Yes, My Brother I Know, sung by John Noble, conducted by Sir Charles Groves.
Yes, my brother I know.
You've just heard from Sea Drift, sung by John Noble, is exactly why Sir Thomas Beecham called Frederick Delius the last great apostle of romantic beauty in music. You heard the mysticism, the ecstasy of sight, the sense of loss combined with the sense of aspiration toward healing, toward unity with the world. Which unfortunately, though, in this piece, does not happen. We're going to move now to another piece, which is more affirming of, from the point of view of Delius's Nietzschean point of view. It's actually a setting called The Mass of Life of parts of Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra. And I've chosen what to me is a very special part of it. It's a very short prelude in the second part. It's only a few minutes long, followed by a chorus of women singing what's called the dance song. And it is actually a very early recording. It's from a 78 made by Sir Thomas Beecham back in the 30s. The setting is that Zarathustra is wandering through the forest. He comes upon a meadow surrounded by trees, bushes, and he sees young girls dancing and singing. Listen closely to the chordal changes in the first 12 bars, this beautiful moment from the Mass of Life. ¶¶ just as the ladies' voices come in to sing the dance song, we're going to move to our next piece. Remind you, that was a moment from Delius's Great Massive Life, 1906, which is performed very rarely, but luckily tomorrow night in Carnegie Hall. I will hear the first performance of it in the United States since 1974, a performance I was also at. Now we're going to listen to another of my personal favorite Delius. It's a piece that had been gestating with him since he was in Florida and Virginia in those early years before he returned to Europe to go to Leipzig. It's called Appalachia, and it's a set of variations on an Appalachian theme. And we're going to listen to the third of these variations. There are 16 of them. But Eric Finby, the young man who went as an amanuensis to help Delius complete four or five very important compositions late in his life when he was paralyzed and blind, said that in this variation there was the first expression of what he called a moment of revelation in Delius. That revelation being the transitoriness of all mortal things mirrored in nature. And I will say that the first time I heard this, without ever hearing what Eric Finby had to say about it, it absolutely captured my ear and my imagination. So let's listen to, again, Sir Thomas Beecham, who is the greatest of all Delius conductors, play the third variation from Delius's Appalachia. Thank you. That's the third variation of 16 variations from Appalachia by Frederick Delius. As you listened, you heard a rather raucous Appalachian theme, a kind of a dance theme, suddenly interrupted by muted strings playing very, very softly, and a kind of stillness was created as if the composer suddenly looked up at the sky and watched the clouds pass by in between the peaks. It's a very, very powerful moment, and as Eric Finby said, as far as he could tell, that first moment of revelation in Delius, which looked ahead to what the kinds of moments we've heard in The Mass of Life, The Village Romeo and Juliet, and Sea Drift. Now, I told you we weren't going to leave you hanging about the fate of the lovers from Delius' opera, Village Romeo and Juliet, Sally and Rayleigh, and I guess you know it's not going to end well for them. I'm going to play for you now the final scene from that opera. Again, it's the performed by Meredith Davies, and Sally and Vrenchen are sung by Robert Teer and Elizabeth Harwood. You'll also hear the boatmen, as you did in the previous clip, from their voyage down the river, except that in this scene, Sally pulls the plug from the bottom of the boat so that it will sink into the river and they will die. The final scene from A Village Romeo and Juliet. Final scene from Delius's opera, A Village Romeo and Juliet, first performed in 1907. Notice how the mood of the orchestral finale is not entirely tragic at all. He lets it be bold and beautiful. Just a note of dissonance. There's also almost a sense of chordal affirmation, even kind of peacefulness. And I might comment here that for Delius, a composer without faith, without knowing his true destination, where his thirst for happiness is coming from or taking him, this love death, like that in Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, is the kind of apotheosis he can imagine. He can't go beyond nature. Except, unlike Wagner's Tristan, this is not a willful overcoming. There's no shouting. There's no baring the breast. It's a merging. Sally and Braley, they merge. They wrap themselves back into nature from whence they came. The selves of the individual lovers completely disappear. If only Delius had known the author of nature, well, perhaps he does now. We could only pray and let his beautiful music be his prayer as well. After the break, I will introduce you to a very interesting guest.
A message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
Jesus instructs us to not be afraid. Yet one common fear is that of loneliness or thinking no one cares. This can cloud our lives with disillusion and despair. However, we are never alone. As John's Gospel and letters emphasize, God is love and cares for us so much that he redeemed us through Jesus, his Son. And Jesus did not redeem us as strangers, but as people he knows well enough to call by individual name. On Easter morning, Mary Magdalene rejoiced when she heard Jesus call her name, and Jesus is waiting for us to rejoice as he calls our names each day. Let us pray that we can hear God calling our name and know that we are loved as his children. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, CBSMICH.org.
On January 12, 2013, Ave Maria Radio held its first conference, Catholic Witness in a Nation Divided. Deal Hudson was the keynote speaker.
Now, it's my observation that most Catholic activists, regardless of their place on the political spectrum, theological spectrum, right or left, consider themselves better Catholics than others. And I include myself. I mean, that is why activists on the right and the left spend so much time beating up on each other, because they're operating from the same assumption.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Deal Hudson's title was Why It All Comes Back to What Catholics Don't or Won't Do. Listen to Deal Hudson's talk from Catholic Witness at a Nation Divided on the next Putting on the Mind of Christ. It's heard this and every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet. Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
If you act nice, will your kids imitate you? A mother told me once, I've decided how to handle my daughter's bratty behavior. I realize that what I need to do is simply act nice. When she gets mean, I'll just respond by being very, very nice, very kind. And over time, she'll model my behavior and she'll realize that's not the way to act. Well, first of all, my question was, how long can we act nice in the face of escalating brattiness? Second of all, what are we really teaching? On one hand, it is important to model the behaviors we want to teach, but on the other hand, it is just as important to take an active role in teaching those behaviors. In other words, what I wanted to say to Mom was, yes, act as nice as you can, but be firm about it. And when behavior gets bratty, what are you going to do about it? If you continue to respond with niceness in the face of brattiness, my experience tells me that the brattiness will just increase and your niceness will become battered and bruised, and pretty soon you won't feel like being nice anymore. I'm Dr. Ray.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to